you were actually a critic for Time. You lived in New York for a long time, and you just left, huh? I guess some time ago you left.
It'll be 3 years ago this August. Went to California to make my fame and fortune.
Well, you already had a lot of fame and fortune, but you had to leave the money bags for the creative impulse out there, huh?
Actually, I went out to produce some television shows, documentaries about various people involved in the movie business, historically for the most part. Did a show about Vincent Minnelli for PBS, did a show about Cary Grant for ABC, and just finished a show on Gary Cooper, which is being hosted by Clint Eastwood on TNT. It'll be on next fall. So there was that, and then there was the usual real estate considerations that went into the decision to move.
And you're still with Time.
Yeah, yeah.
How do you connect with Time? A modem?
By modem, yeah, sure. I mean, in the great new communications world, it's really terribly easy. You know, it's actually easier to sit in my study out there, modem the thing in, than it used to be here in town where I'd write at home, bring the typed copy up by subway or by car late at night.
Well, you wouldn't do that here anymore, you're there.
Probably not. I'd be hooked in by modem
right,
from here.
Right.
I can't write in offices. I mean, that's one of the things one of the few things I've learned definitively in life, that offices are great for schmoozing, conferencing, you know, hanging out around the water cooler. But they're no good for writing.
Oh, it's tough. Well, of course, we do hard news writing here mostly. Well, I do my my book series, which has been on the air for many years, I do in the newsroom usually. And it is so noisy, but I find that somehow I just, over the years, I've been able to blot it out.
I'm just an infinitely distractible human being. I mean, you know, I guess I'd rather do anything in this world than write. So if somebody wants to come by and have a little chat, I'm always ready.
Well, you have been interested, I would say probably preoccupied by film for many years. Why do you have this can I call it an obsession? That may be a little strong.
Actually, I like the word obsession. I think it's a terrific word, and I think describes a condition that probably more people should indulge, oddly enough. I mean, in other words, I think people who don't have a passion for a subject, especially if they're writers about it, probably have got the wrong subject or possibly the wrong line of work. I mean, I think obsessions are important to it. So I would say that the only thing I'd add to your description is it's kind of become a growing obsession. That is to say, you know, as with this book, a desire to look back in more detail at films and filmmakers and film people who are now sort of passed into history so that you can get a little perspective on them. I think that's where my obsession is taking me. It's more into the past than into the present or into the future, obviously.
You grew up in the Midwest?
Yeah.
Where?
In Wisconsin.
Wisconsin. And you look to be a man perhaps in the mid-40s?
Oh, thank you. Mid-50s.
Mid-50s. Well, you're holding up very well. So you go back to a time before television, and growing up, if you're in your mid-50s, you grew up where you probably went,
I did,
to the Saturday morning fun shows.
I was of the last generation that did not grow up on television. I mean, in other words, the first television set came into our house in, I think I was about 14. So, you know, that sort of...
You were ahead of me. My father was holding out for color, and he didn't get his first set until 1958. I was off in college.
Well, I pressed. I wanted to see Uncle Milty and the wrestling matches and all that good stuff.
You know, the teacher in class would say, "Now, class, there was such and such a show on television last night. Who saw it?" All the hands would go up. Mine would also go up. You know, I was afraid of being an outcast. I didn't want people to know that my father was holding up.
I think what a wonderful, innocent time in television that was, where there was sufficient television so that, you know, every two or three days they'd say, "Did you see, we're going to talk about the," or they would say, "There's a show on tonight you should look at. It's important, you know, we'll be discussing it in tomorrow's lessons." I mean, I don't think that probably happens more than on a kind of an occasional basis nowadays on television. But in those days, you know, there was a certain idealism around television, you know, a sense that this was a great medium that had enormous potential for education, for bringing people, the world closer together, all that stuff, which, you know, maybe it does, but in some way we think of it as more of a pollutant than an advantage, I guess, in society.
Of course, you're doing a lot of television work, too, which is very helpful. And in the book, you cite a wonderful television documentary about Chaplin, for example, that had more than almost any film.
Absolutely. Marvelous documentary by Kevin Brownlow and David Gill about Chaplin's creative methods, working methods as an actor-director. I think it's a marvelous piece of work. Sure, television. I mean, to say so myself, I just finished doing a show about Gary Cooper, which will be on TNT next fall. And I think it's a terrific show. I mean, in the sense that when you go into the 80 movies or so that he made, you start pulling out scenes, you sort of deconstruct them and put them into the show, you begin to see his characteristics as an actor, his strengths as an actor, which were much higher than I think most people thought of at the time, or maybe think of now. I mean, they think of him as a guy who went yup and nope a lot, which in fact he did very rarely. He was quite an articulate man in life and very often on the screen. So I think that kind of work, the kind that Kevin and David do, the kind that I try to do, I think is valuable. I regard it as, yeah, it's entertainment, but I also regard it as a kind of logical extension of what I try to do critically.
Well, isn't it an irony that when I was a kid and you were a kid, we went probably once a week, maybe twice a week to the movies?
Sure. Unfortunately, I still do.
Well, I don't. I don't go to the movies anymore. But I do have a video recorder, mm-hmm. and I tape movies from Channel 13, Channel 21, the PBS stations, from HBO, from mm-hmm. Showtime. I probably have close to 2,000 movies, uncut movies that I am maintaining, and I have a lot of space problems, of course. But I'm watching more movies now than I ever watched when
I was
a kid.
Well, I would say that's also true of me. I mean, one thing, here we are sitting in the CBS building and I'm saying it, but I would say that nowadays, maybe 80 or 90% of my television watching is either a tape of the kind you describe, a tape rented from the video store perhaps, or just sitting down and watching an old movie on one of the, you know, several channels that now play a great many old movies.
What a wonderful way of recapturing those films that were only in our memories before. Now you can actually hold them in your hands.
And from my point of view, being, you know, sort of an inveterate critic, it leads me, I suppose, to the kind of material that's in this book. I mean, a lot of it is simply based on, as I think I say in the introduction to the book, you're never finished with a movie. You know, they kind of turn up again in your life. Well, there it is on channel whatever. And you say, gosh, I haven't seen that since I was a kid. I'd like to see that again. And so you watch it, and then you're now looking at it as theoretical grown up, at least, and you're looking at it from a different perspective and seeing things in it, and actually doing something that's terribly hard to do in life. You're actually revising significant memories, because movies, as I guess they were for you, or certainly were for me, significant memories. I mean, a lot of what we of that generation who, as I say, were moviegoers, not TV watchers, those movies formed us in very significant ways.
And some of them have actually held up quite well. Others haven't, yeah. But it's still, nostalgically, it's kind of nice to see them. Some early Donald O'Connor movies that I thought were terrific, I can't remember. No, it wasn't. I was just watching one the other day. It was so funny. I think it had Donald O'Connor in it and Bobby Vann.
That sounds right.
Maybe it may have had Debbie Reynolds.
Uh-huh.
Oh, it was the one about the kid on campus. I think it was...
It's called Good News, isn't it?
No, it was... This was very... It was in the maybe late 40s, 50s, early 50s. And I think it was based on a weekly column that was called Big Man on Campus. Well, anyway...
Oh, yeah. I know what it was.
And the guy, the author...
Max Shulman.
Max Shulman.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to say Bud Shulman.
Yeah.
I didn't want to have to say Bud Shulman because I knew it wasn't right. But, yeah, Max Shulman.
It would have been Bud Schulberg.
And he had...
Max Shulman was a... He had that column, and he wrote a book that was beloved when I was a kid growing up, starting to read, called Barefoot Boy with Cheek.
Right.
And I went to the University of Wisconsin. Max Shulman went to the University of Minnesota. And so there's a lot of crossovers in our experience. It's, by the way, a hilarious and almost surreal book about campus life, Barefoot Boy with Cheek. And it was kind of a thrill for me. I mean, I was... some years ago, making a television show, standing around in the Universal Commissary, and there was a writer there I knew online, and he introduced me to Max Shulman, with whom he was then writing a screenplay.
Well, I had a point to this digression. I had watched it, and it was corny. Mm-hmm. It was corny, it was silly, it was done on a back lot.
Yeah.
So I got my family, and I said, you really have to see, this is what college was like in mm-hmm. the late 40s, yeah. early 50s. Can't remember the exact year the thing came out.
Yeah.
And you were going to find this funny. It's really a funny antique, and they could not watch it. They both got up after a few minutes, and they walked out. They could
well, that's
not.
That's a very true thing about watching old movies, isn't it? I mean, it's some of them are very, very locked to their time, and unless you have had some personal experience of that historical moment, you are not going to get with that movie. On the other hand, a lot of movies are entirely timeless. I mean, you know, you show them to a little kid, and they will get something out of it. You know, the humor of having a leopard on a leash and the leopard getting off the leash and, say, something like bringing a baby, this is fairly universal, that kind of screwball farce. And I was just at the theater last night here in New York and saw a good show I just love called Lend Me a Tenor. And it's, you know, the most classic kind of farce, set in, I think, 1934 in Cleveland. And I think it's wonderful. And there was a little kid sitting next to me, and he was getting off on it just as well as I was.
Well, let's talk about Chicalon Film. Here's a book that represents not only your love for the medium, but
and my obsession,
your obsession, but also your knowledge, because you explain a lot about what goes on. You obviously know your stuff. Talk about Cooper. I mean, you cite film after film after film, the vast majority of which I have never seen. First, tell me how the book came about. I know it was a series of essays originally, right?
You know, writing for Time leads other magazines to call up and offer you something that Time can't usually offer you, which is something more than 80 lines to express yourself on. A lot of these were written for a magazine called Film Comment, which my colleague at Time in Moonlights and Edits, Richard Corliss. Others were written on various occasions for various reasons. And the important thing about it is, you know, to avoid that deathly phrase, a collection. I think everything in the book has been revised, expanded, for the most part rethought. A lot of the pieces actually bear very little resemblance to their original form. The point is that, unlike reviewing movies on a daily basis or weekly basis where you have very little choice, you know, you have to review this week's movie this next week, or this week, preferably. These are kind of things, if an editor says to you, well, would you like to write something on Charlie Chaplin? You say, yeah, I've always wanted to do that. Or, nah, I don't want to write about whoever. Or conversely, in some of these cases, I proposed myself. I mean, I got to seeing some old Ronald Reagan movies on television and got to thinking about Ronald Reagan not so much as a politician, but Ronald Reagan as an actor. And I got to feeling that, though politically he and I would not be in the same camp, that he was kind of getting a bum shake as an actor. It's a funny thing to say.
You mean he's not as bad as everyone says?
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, his range was extremely limited. I mean, you know, we're not talking Cooper, who actually had quite a big range. But, you know, in a kind of realm of light comedy, he was very funny. He had a nice kind of goofy, youthful quality that I thought came across pretty well on the screen. And you know what? It was not an insignificant career.
And you make the point that you should probably express that he did not do villains well.
I think I had a nice phrase, if I can recall it, in the book. I'm thinking in particular of his role, which is probably the best part he ever had, close to the best part he ever had, in King's Row. In the early going, before he famously loses his legs, he's supposed to play a bit of a rake and a roué and all that. And I said, you know, he's in that part, he's not an actor looking for a role. You know, he's really a politician trying to make friends. He does not suit, he doesn't really feel comfortable being anything but what he apparently is, a rather amiable man. That kind of leap was beyond him as an actor. But in that range of light comedy, which there's not a lot of call for anymore, he was very expert. I thought he had wonderful timing, you know, a good sense of where the laugh was, and he could do it.
One of the most interesting chapters in this book dealt with the Hollywood Ten.
Mm-hmm.
What this took place in the mid 1940s.
1948 is the beginning of it. Hearings by the House of Representatives, House on American Activities Committee.
Apparently, if I read this chapter correctly, you believe there's a lot of revisionist.
This is the most determinedly controversial piece in the book. I do not wish to revise in any way, shape, or form the notion that, you know, hearings into people's political opinions or punishment, in this case, loss of jobs, and blacklisting, and so forth, as well as for the original 10 jail terms for contempt of Congress. I do not want to revise anybody's thinking that that is a reprehensible practice and one we may hope does not return to this country ever. On the other hand, it is important to understand, and this is where, you know, I think kids really do not understand these terms anymore. It is important to understand that the entire Hollywood Ten were members of the Stalinist left, which is not the same as being part of the liberal or socialist left or any of those factions of the left wing. That these people were entirely serious about their politics, and that they have very largely written the history of that period in American political life, particularly as pertains to communism, quote-unquote, and Hollywood. These people were card-carrying communists. They have commanded the historical record. That's what I'm saying. And what I'm also saying in the piece is there were people who had quit the party, who really had no principled reason to continue in support of the party or in support of the Ten, and were faced with really a gruesome choice, which was do something that no one wants to do, which is, you know, tell tales, name names, whatever it was, or conversely, make common cause with people that they had already split with, politically speaking, and in effect put themselves, who else would speak to them, put themselves back into the communist or Stalinist fold. I take the position that it was a tough time. That was a tough decision. There may have been people who did it for purely selfish reasons to go on working, but I think there were people of principle who did, in fact, reluctantly and considerable anguish, talk, and I don't think they should necessarily be drummed out of human Congress.
Well, don't you make the point that many of these people were indeed artists, and when they were approached by the hardliners, they really couldn't be propagandists?
I did know one or two of those people, and I certainly know that for them to face the blacklist in company with people that they no longer politically agreed with and abandon their careers as artists at the same time was an impossible choice to ask them to make. And I have to say, we none of us know, projecting ourselves into historical circumstances, how we would behave. But if I had been a member of the Stalinist left and had left that group and had a commitment or an obsession to my work, I'm not at all certain that I would not have done what a number of people did, which was name names that the committee in any event already had. I think some of these people go on paying the rest of their lives. I mean, think of Elia Kazan, who was, you know, a major authorial figure in American film in the 40s and 50s, and it seems to me that as a result of his political stance, and he was one of the people who named names, that the body of his work has not been critically attended to in any substantive form since. I think he's a much more important artist and significant figure in our cultural history than a kind of mindlessly liberal-oriented critical establishment will permit him to be.
There's another irony that you point out, the fact that the Communist Party really was not that well entrenched in Hollywood at that time.
There was that fact. I mean, it was. On the other hand, there's another kind of funny thing that is growing up, which is the notion that all communists never got any of their views in the movies. But that's not true. It doesn't make any difference to me that they got their views into movies. But again, just for the to state the historical record accurately, particularly in the sort of popular front period during World War II, these guys were very good at that kind of popular front rhetoric. And World War II American movies are loaded with them. And these guys piled up most of their screen credits during that period because it was a time when their particular political slant was, as usual in Hollywood, it was, you know, don't... he can't come on this lot unless we need him. Well, they needed him. And they came on a lot, and they wrote a lot of the wartime movies. Again, this is not something... I think, hey, great, if you can... write quote-unquote subversively in the midst of American capitalism. That's an amusing and a not entirely unworthy thing to do. But I will say the rhetoric rings particularly false and kind of stupefying nowadays in the midst of war movies. I mean, always the action stops for somebody to make a speech about the brave new world that we're fighting for or... issue some rhetoric on behalf of the common man and his simple common virtues and all that stuff. I mean, so, yeah, I mean, they had a significant effect on screen content if you want to know the truth.
Now, you've organized your book. You have directors organized. You have some of the great stars organized. But I see way out here, all by himself, is Woody Allen.
Yeah.
You have kind of a special relationship with Allen, don't you?
I wouldn't say so. because that would make... if you read the piece, you know, carefully, the point is I've known him, I don't know, over 20-odd years, I guess.
But he is different, isn't he? He's a writer, he's an actor, he's a director of the most unique...
Yeah, I guess what I was trying to say in the piece was knowing him, you know, casually and pleasantly when I lived in New York, seeing him around, chatting with him occasionally. I think, as I say in the piece, he leads a life... that is coherent and understandable to me. And most people who make movies do not lead lives that are coherent and understandable to me. I mean, in other words, you know, they live in vast Beverly Hills mansions and drive cars I can't even pronounce the names of. And generally...
Ford.
No, that was Italian. Italianate names that I don't understand. Whereas Woody leads a life that's familiar to me. It's a rather writerly life. I mean, he works very hard. He goes from picture to picture. He doesn't take vacations. He's a well-read man. He's a man very much involved in the cultural life of this city. He talks a language that I, as a writer, apprehend as a writerly language, and that he has, this is not to by any means denigrate his capacities as growing capacities as a filmmaker, as a man who can communicate in visual as well as literary terms. But he is a writerly person, and I understand writerly persons, but he's not a writerly person in the way that screenwriters are, who are for the most part not writerly persons, if that sentence makes any sense.
But he does have a uniqueness, doesn't he? He's different from...
Anyway, what I'm trying to say is, to me, it's a comprehensible life. That's life. I mean, he certainly is not a man... I mean, he's a man who's, I should guess, has... accumulated a certain amount of wealth from his work, but he does not show that wealth off in the Beverly Hills manner or in the manner of most movie makers. I mean, he's devoted obsessively to his work, the phrase that, you know, you and I keep kind of bandying about, but I, as I say, I admire obsession. I certainly admire it more than materialism. And so I just plain like him. I also feel very strongly that this is a body of work that will loom very large, historically speaking. I mean, I think in, you know, 20, 40, 100 years, however long film lasts, I have a feeling people will look at this work as, first of all, portraying a significant stratum of American life at this particular time, and second of all, I think it's work that has, especially as he when he dresses... question of the relationship between men and women is going to have a certain universality. I think these movies will be something that kids not now living will be able to look at and say, yeah, I get that. That's the way it goes between men and women.
I've always wanted to go to Elaine's, but I never wanted to confront the hostility of Elaine or the waiter, so I keep waiting for Woody to invite me to go and sit at his table, and so far he hasn't. Are you listening, Woody? But there's another artist that you have. We're almost out of time, so we do have to cover a couple things real quick. You have another artist all out there by himself. It's Charles Chaplin, a chap you call Benighted Artist. Why is he separated from the rest of the actors?
Chaplin, and the contrast I'm trying to enforce by that arrangement, Chaplin beginning the book and Woody ending it, I think Chaplin was an artist who did become dissociated, alienated from his work by his wealth and by his celebrity, and I have a feeling that Woody is very cognizant of how that can happen to you. Now, Chaplin has an excuse. He was very nearly the first movie celebrity, and the whole weight of that kind of fame and money and international adoration came down on him, and he had very little preparation for it. Nonetheless, I do feel that it grievously afflicted his work as a mature artist.
That he did not capitalize on.
He became lost to himself. And so, look, art requires being in touch with some aspect of yourself. And my sense of Chaplin is that he entirely lost touch with those aspects of him that had made him beloved in the first place.
But outside of that terrible speech at the end of The Great Dictator, I thought that was a charming movie. I mean, that scene of the Fuhrer bouncing the ball up in the
air. A marvelous conceit. Sure, I'm not saying that. Look, he was a figure of enormous stature in the history of movies. I do say that, to my taste at any rate, none of the sound films are as good as his earlier work. It seems to me he peaked somewhere around the Gold Rush, maybe.
But, of course, he pioneered this early work, and perhaps not adjust as sound came in.
Yeah. Well, that was certainly a problem for him.
Now, we can look back. You're a historian. You can look back at the 20s, the silent pictures, the groundbreaking films of the 30s, and there are a few in the 40s. And we can almost see
a lot in the 40s.
Yeah.
I think.
We can see.
I think the great Hollywood golden age it certainly extends from the high silent period, say dated at 1925, when that particular expressive form began to reach a kind of peak, through say 1945, to pick an arbitrary date, when the movies were in full command of their power over the audience and their full wealth. Really.
Well, what's happening now? And we're really out of time because I have a 2:00. But what's happening now with regard to movies, and where are they going to go? You know, we've got the technology has changed. Movies are in our house every day, and high definition is going to come along.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't even like to go to theaters anymore because I don't like to hear people talking and step on the crap that is left on the seat and the chair.
Well, it's funny. I still do like to go to theaters. I like to go to theaters better than I like to go to, you know, critic screenings. I mean, frankly, I'd rather be amongst ordinary people watching a movie than, you know, my colleagues, most of whom I think are perfect twits. So I still like to go out to a movie. Nonetheless, what you say is perfectly true. I mean, as we've discussed earlier, one does tend to see more movies, you know, on videotape in one form or another.
Well, how many really good movies are there in a year? 10?
If you're lucky.
Yeah.
I mean, I make up half of the time 10 best list, and there are certainly years when I'm hard-pressed to find 5 that I really think are terrific movies. I mean, from last year, I guess I would name something like Babette's Feast, and I would probably name Pelé the Conqueror and Wings of Desire. None of those I notice American movies. But hey, how many great novels were published in a given year? I mean, you know, three really quite fine movies that you would reasonably predict would outlive their time is not a bad year in an art. I mean, it's just that we're, you know, kind of convinced that.
Yeah, but the that's not a good comparison. A novel may not be great, but you can have high quality novels, you know, B's. B pluses, A minuses, that will still be around for a long time and are produced with a relatively low amount of expense. But movies are so expensive that you wonder how they ever get produced at all. And so it becomes a bottom-line industry, more so than even the publishing industry, which is also bottom-line, of course. But at least the publishers will, like Simon & Schuster is notorious for it, they'll have all these blockbuster novels, but at the same time, if you read their catalog, they'll have first novels in there. They'll have a few really good literary novels.
Oh, that's true. I do think there is potential just in this very video revolution you're talking about. I think there is a potential for a kind of first novel kind of film being financed, at a lowish level. I'm a good example from last year, The Thin Blue Line, this documentary. It would never have been made if there wasn't somebody saying, all right, I'll take the video rights, and somebody else, saying, okay, I'll take some international TV distribution rights, and it's enough money to make a modest and to my judgment, quite a marvelous documentary film. I think that potential is there within the video revolution. Whether that potential will be realized, I don't know. I mean, there was always potential in the great high studio days for inexpensive B-movies that took up either serious subject matter or were made with some experimental, if you will, flair. They didn't use that opportunity in the B-pictures as they might have. But certainly people like Irving Thalberg at MGM, you know, that was one of his intentions. He would say to directors who had a vision or a dream or whatever, he would say, this studio can't afford the occasional artistic failure. It's okay. Go ahead. As he said a couple of times to say King Vidor, for example. So that potential is there. It's not been realized in our movie past. We might hope that it would be realized in our kind of video-driven future.
Movies made for television and for cable, will they ever reach the quality of some of the milestone films that were made for the theaters?
Well, whether you mean glitz and flash and glamour and strut and swagger, which is, kind of the fun of, say, a high 1930s MGM musical or comedy or Weeper, they won't have that quality, which is, of course, beloved by, gentlemen your age and my age, but and ladies, too, of course. I don't know whether that's possible, but certainly it's possible to make works of modest scope and stature at relatively low budgets, essentially for, let's call it a video market, some combination of broadcast and tape distribution.
But the question, the reason I asked the question is that I just see fewer and fewer motion picture theaters functioning in the future as the technology improves for the home audience.
That may be true. I mean, it's certainly true that, the classic theaters are almost all gone now. And yet, every time I pick up the newspaper, somebody like Cineplex Odeon is opening a new six-screen facility somewhere or other.
With 150 seats.
Yeah, but you know what? Those work out pretty well. I mean, now that I live in L.A., and my nearest screens tend to be multiplexes.
Well, I saw the Mosquito Coast a while ago at a theater that I swear the screen couldn't have been much bigger than that window there looking at the control room.
You are now coming toward the, our eye will accept a smaller screen experience in a theater because it's, of course, conditioned more and more by television. I mean, there's going to come a crossover point where, this kind of big screen projected television images that some people have in their home will be approximately the size of what you go out and pay $7 for in a multiplex. So,
just raised their prices, $7.50 now in New York.
Heaven forfend! I'm glad I live in Los Angeles. It's only $6.50 out there.
Cost of living. Richard, I wish we could go on. I have a lot of other questions, but I'm way overdue now. I'm out of time. I enjoyed reading your thoughts about your encounters, critical and personal, with Movie Immortals. Richard Schickel on film. Terrific book.
Thank you very much.